Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with harpsichordist Mark Kroll. Without having taken a lesson, five-year-old Mark could play by ear the pieces that his eight-year-old brother had been studying to learn. This so horrified his brother that he gave up the piano. But Mark never did. He pursued the piano until at 17, he heard the harpsichord, fell in love, embraced it, and never turned back. Listen to this charming story of a man who knew unconsciously at the age of five that he was a musician. Of course, he was right. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person other people are. Not the person you think you have to be in order to be liked or loved. Not the person they told you you had to be. Not even the person you may currently think you are, but the person you really are. Unfortunately, too many children have experiences in their childhood which tell them that something about them, something they look like or sound like or think, some interest or something they're drawn to, is not all right. And the expression of this thing brings a consequence which is unpleasant to the child. Perhaps they're teased or embarrassed or criticized or punished. So children are quite able to pretend that this or that about them is not true. I don't do that. I don't like that. I don't want that. And sometimes the pretense gets so good that they come into adulthood having forgotten who they really are. The Lynn Show is about saying that if this happened to you, if you suspect that there was a quality that you had which you cannot now have access to, or even a quality you'd like to have, and you'd like to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynnshow.com. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And in my interview today with Mark Kroll, you can hear what it sounds like to be a person who knew at five that he was a musician. And fortunately, he was not dissuaded. He was encouraged. And so he could live the life he was meant to live. It's a lovely story. And right before I play my interview with Mark, I'm going to play a little taste of Mark on the harpsichord. So here now is Mark Kroll playing the instrument he fell in love with, followed by my interview. Okay, so I'm here with Mark Kroll, harpsichordist. And I'm explaining to Mark that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And so clearly, the art to which you are giving your life and making your living is that of the harpsichord.
Yes, it is.
I only ask one question. Do you remember the very first moment in your life when music and or harpsichord or any other instrument drew you, called you?
Yes. My mother and father wrote songs, Broadway-style songs. And also when my father would come home from work, he would just fool around on the piano. No. He had no training, but he could play it, you know? Mm-hmm. And my mother wrote the lyrics. My brother took piano lessons. So he, probably about 7 or 8, he's 3 years older. And he got very angry at me because I could play all his pieces without studying.
Yes.
I do it by ear.
I believe you.
And he was, and he gave up piano.
Really?
Bless his soul. We love each other so much. He gave up piano because I'm not going to, you know, this little kid can play my pieces already. So I guess about 5 is when I always loved music. There was music in records and radio,
always in the house. Right.
And we used to listen 19th century music, mainly Debussy, Rachmaninoff, one of those big, wonderful pieces.
Really? Even though they were writing Broadway songs?
Oh, yeah, but both of them were not trained, but they grew up loving music.
Right. Okay, so you started on the piano at...
At five.
And did you have lessons?
I had lessons. I didn't like practicing. I liked playing baseball. And I also took boxing lessons.
Wow.
And I would come from boxing, I was 8 or 9, into my piano lesson. Wow. Not good.
Not for the fingers.
But I always, right, exactly. But I was 9 or 10.
Right.
But I always loved the piano. At 15, I started getting into early music, 17th and 18th century. I was dreaming of being a virtuoso solo pianist.
Already?
Oh, yeah. And my goal was to play the Liszt 6th Hungarian Rhapsody, which has big octaves, as fast as Teresa Carreño, who is a South American pianist of great virtuosity. And I listened to her recording of it every day. I just loved that. I also loved listening to Rachmaninoff's recordings of his own piano concerto. I was into that kind of pianism.
Yes.
But at the age of 15, I started exploring earlier repertoire, Baroque music. And I said, oh, this is interesting. It didn't sound right on the piano.
Ah.
But I never even knew about harpsichord too much. Then at the age of 17, I heard a lot of early music in New York, and a harpsichord recital, and the New York Pro Musica, and Ralph Kirkpatrick, who was a great harpsichordist at the time. And, you know, when you're 17, you're old enough to make decisions, and you're smart, but not enough, and 17 is a dangerous age. And I said, I want to do this.
Yeah.
However, I went to college, Brooklyn College, with a pre-med. I was going to be a good Jewish doctor.
Oh, my goodness.
Of course. And I was good in science. I came with advanced placement in biology and stuff like that. But I ended up sort of hanging around the music department. And so I was hooked. There's an old saying, it's a cliche, but it's a good one. You don't choose music. Music chooses you.
Yes.
And I just couldn't get out of it. Couldn't get away from it.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know how impractical it was because I didn't care just what I wanted to do. So I guess unconsciously knew I was a musician from the age of 5. And consciously from the age of 17, 16, 17.
Okay, so after the freshman year, did you change your major?
Yep.
Yeah.
Music major.
Right.
They didn't have harpsichord lessons there, so it was in New York. I was at Brooklyn College. But I took all the music courses, of course.
Right.
And I took lessons privately in New York. Well, a wonderful curmudgeon of a harpsichordist named Louis Bagger. He's not well known.
So did you have a harpsichord to practice on?
I had a harpsichord at... Brooklyn College, but just access to, which is okay.
Yeah, right.
But then 2 years later, I had to buy a harpsichord. I had no money. My parents had no money. We had no room. It was a small apartment. And so we moved my bed out of my bedroom and put the harpsichord there. I slept in the living room or someplace. I didn't care.
No, you didn't care. What's so interesting to me is here are these parents who adore music, but were counting on having a Jewish doctor.
That's right. They did. And you know, and remember, they were first generation Americans.
Of course.
You know how
yes,
it works.
Right, I do.
But they want, you know, in some ways, I wish they had forbade me to do this so I could be a nice, rich doctor. But and also save people and do something
useful.
You
think music doesn't save people?
Well, yeah, I'd like to think so, but who knows?
It saved you.
It was me.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
No, I don't think it's unfortunate.
It's who I am.
Yes, yes.
So the harpsichord, it was a very small bedroom, filled up I had to climb over something to get into it.
Oh, my God.
And then I got an apartment in my senior year near the college, and I moved the harpsichord there.
I just want to say that given that they wanted a Jewish doctor, and they certainly knew that music was impractical.
Oh, yeah.
They moved the harpsichord into your bedroom. It's extraordinary. That's really lovely.
In fact, thinking about it now, they just did what they thought would make me happy.
Yes, that's clear.
And that's what parents should do.
And you were very lucky.
I was lucky.
Yeah. I like to highlight how important it is for parents to do what your parents did, to support who the child is,
mm-hmm.
not who you would want them to be or even who you think it would be better if they were. But who they are, and your parents did.
Well, and yes, that generation of Jewish parents wanted only one thing to improve the children will do better.
Yes.
And the system at the time, thank God for New York.
Right.
And for the public colleges.
Colleges.
We couldn't afford it. College.
No.
And everything was geared to supporting. I had a great faculty at Brooklyn College.
Yes.
Because they were all emigres from Europe.
Yes, 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 right. And to be there.
Oh, happy to be there. And they were just wonderful. Yeah, it's true. Wish I could thank them again now.
Okay, so you major in music?
I major in music at Brooklyn College.
Yes.
I got my BA.
Right, and what happens?
Well, I got a job as the music teacher at Brooklyn Technical High School. And that's probably would have gone. But then all of a sudden, at the last minute, a graduate fellowship opened up at Brooklyn to be the assistant pianist and conductor for the opera theater.
Ooh.
But also to study musicology. So I did that for a year. I learned a lot. But I said, harpsichord. So I auditioned for Yale School of Music. Took the bus up, Trailways bus up to New Haven,
mm-hmm.
to audition with Ralph Kirkpatrick, who was the professor there.
Wow.
Full circle.
Mm-hmm.
And he accepted me. It was a 4-hour audition.
My God.
The first hour, we spoke about Dürer and other German engravers in German, and my German was basic. The second hour, he tested me on figured bass. Now, figured bass is where a harpsichordist makes up an accompaniment, and there are numbers that tell you what chords to play. By the third hour, I was ready to play my pieces, and I imagine at that time, I have no idea how it sounded. It was so awful. And then fourth hour, he was having me do some musicianship exercises. 4 hours.
It's exhausting.
I walked out. I could have walked into traffic.
Yeah, bet.
Yeah, and I assumed, oh, I blew it.
Yeah.
And he puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "Look forward to seeing here next year." He was the old style, right?
Mm-hmm, you know? Right.
And I got accepted. I studied with him. I got my master's. Mm-hmm. I was lucky because this is the beginning of a real bubble of harpsichord. This was 71. And between 1970, 68, 70, and 1990 was golden years for being a harpsichordist. There was a lot of interest, many builders, lots of activity. So I got two job offers. One was to be an artist in residence at a consortium of colleges in North Carolina. And it was a lot of money at that. $10,000 a year just to play.
Wow.
In 1971.
Right.
I had no money, zero
money. Right.
And then an old student of mine had gone out to University of California, Santa Cruz. I said, how's it going? He said, oh, it's the most beautiful place on earth. Oh, how nice. And then he writes back to the ladies and says, would you like to teach here? Okay, I've never been to California. And I got a job for $1,000 a year.
Oh, my God.
Plus in residence.
Right.
So, of course.
Yes, of course.
I took that one.
Yes, right.
I've never seen California. I got to go. It was the right decision.
Yeah.
The concerts, I started my career there. I had lots of interesting, fabulous students, actually. Some of them have become quite famous. Mm-hmm. I don't take credit for them. And I played, and I had gave me a harpsichord. I put it in my resident big room. I practiced like crazy. Okay, lots of concerts. Then in 1974, Carol probably told you that we met at Yale.
Actually, she told me you would tell me the story.
I'll tell you the true story.
Tell me the true story.
We met. She was the top violinist in the school. And I was a harpsichordist, and then we get these offers to do weddings. You know, $25 a night, split two or three ways.
Yeah, right.
It was a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, that would pay for a lot of food for the whole week.
Yeah.
And so we had our first rehearsal, and harpsichordists in general have a tendency to be arrogant.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. And so in the middle of rehearsal, I said, clearly you know nothing about Baroque music. Carol, being as sweet and as diplomatic as she was, remember, she's the best violinist in school, didn't say anything. But after, as she walked out, she said to herself, she told me later, what an asshole. 2 weeks later, we were living together, and that was 49 years ago.
Oh, wow.
She probably does still think I'm an asshole, but that's okay. But
She credits you with encouraging her to play Baroque violin.
Yeah, well, blame me or credit?
No, credit. Absolutely, yeah. Credit. Absolutely. Yeah.
She didn't do that then. Why should she? She was playing Brahms and Rachmaninoff and... She wanted to. And yeah. I helped her. I knew the stuff.
Right.
And I'm much more now, as we all do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so we launched a career together as a duo that we traveled all over the world.
Yes.
And made many recordings. And had a very good career,
mm-hmm.
But she also maintained her modern violin playing too, because, you know, I couldn't live without Brahms. Who could? Or Tchaikovsky or any of that great stuff too.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't play it. I can't play it anymore. Oh, the technique is so different. But for me, but yeah. So we've had it's been okay. And you know, being married to your business partner, basically,
yes,
it can be difficult. Obviously, we're still together. But if you have a bad rehearsal, you can't go home to your wife and complain about
your partner, right? Yeah. So did you occasionally have a bad rehearsal?
Sure. I was still arrogant.
Yes.
No, everybody has rehearsals where you're rushing. Not that way.
Yes,
you
right.
Know, I mean,
right.
Everybody... If you have too many bad rehearsals, you know, play together again. But,
well, the other thing that occurs to me is that my impression of Carol and also my impression of you is that you are highly skilled, very professional, and therefore might be expected to think that whatever it is that you are doing or whatever it is that you are hearing is correct. Both of you is what I'm thinking. No? Yes, you're... Nodding.
Yeah. Oh.
Yes. And, right. You're nodding. Right.
It's recording.
So, and if you had a difference of opinion about it, you might still think you were the one who was correct.
Well, that's true, and that's the thing. If you don't think you're correct to begin with,
right,
and if you don't think this is the way I want to play, you can't.
That's right.
You have to be committed to doing something, and there are so many ways to play a note.
Yes.
Or a phrase. I mean, you know, so many ways. You know, people who, they used to use a term in my field, which I hated, called authentic performance.
Ugh.
There's no such thing.
Right.
It's always different. Everybody has a different way to interpret. That's why music is wonderful.
Yes.
You know, music is, that's one of the only arts, perhaps drama too, but where everybody has the same words or notes and phrases, and yet everybody interprets them differently, and they're all right, and that's one of the great things. Yeah, so we would have arguments, but that's what's great.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what chamber music is really all about.
Yes.
Chamber music is as democratic as it could be. No one tells the other one how to play. And you always have to be in sync with each other.
Yes.
When a great quartet is playing, for example, four string players, and they're all convinced they have the right way to do it.
Yes.
But they create one sound, and that's a great quartet.
Yes.
There are not that many of them. There are fine playing quartets, but very few that were, you knew right away, this was the four into one.
Yes, four into one. That's, I was thinking of trying to find a way to say it, but yes, because somehow the thing is larger than the individuals.
Exactly.
Right? And that they give to that. They surrender to that, right?
Yeah, yeah. 1+1, and for a duo, 1+1=1.
That's right. Okay, so you guys played, this was part of Carol's doctorate.
She explained how that works,
yeah, she
right?
did, yeah. Right, she did. And so you do this for how long did you do? Are you still doing it?
Yep.
You're still doing it, okay.
Started right. playing in 1969 and we haven't stopped.
That's lovely. Yeah. So one can imagine that you are really 1+1=1.
Oh, now, people always notice that.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, we don't even have to look at each other.
No. So I know Carol is still teaching. She's still running back and forth. What about you?
I retired.
Did you?
Early. We both had teaching jobs. As a harpsichordist, there's no way you could make a living.
No, I was thinking... I mean, even the golden age couldn't have been that much work.
Nope. We moved to Boston in 74, because that was the harpsichord center at the time. And when I moved to Boston in 74, there was one harpsichord recital a week.
Wow.
Right. Now if there's one harpsichord recital a year or two.
Right.
And so I had a lot of chance to play. We had a lot of chamber music and duos. I was the harpsichordist for the Boston Symphony. I started in 79. And I stopped playing about 2010. I work with Seiji Ozawa, Leonard Burns, George Salty, Colin Davis, James Levine. I wasn't full time because they didn't use harpsichord all the time. So I got lucky. I was playing great music with, I made a recording with Jesse Norman, for example.
Oh my God.
We're doing a piece by Britten called Phedra. And the first rehearsal was just Seiji, me, and Jesse Norman.
My God.
Yeah, we're just a keyboard.
Yes, right.
She comes in. That's a room not very big, but, and she opens her mouth. I've never heard anything that big. Up close? What a sound. Beautiful. And I think she was holding back. So these are all the great experiences I had, but still, my mother was right.
Yes, right.
I got a job at Boston University, where I was tenured and professor and all that good stuff, which is nice.
Yes.
And I was there for 25 years.
Wow.
And then I said, okay. Well, I left for a number of reasons. One was really altruistic. The other was I was burned out.
Yeah, done.
Yeah. But I also noticed that each year my students got better and better and better. And each year that they got better, their opportunities to earn a living got fewer and fewer. And I said, I can't do this to them.
No, it's not fair.
I can't do this to them. Right. I know what's out there.
Right.
And but I also wanted to go back to musicology, too.
Mm.
And so I've written 4 books, 8 editions.
I see. This isn't exactly retirement.
Oh, no.
No.
I've never worked so hard in my life.
Yes, right.
I've made a lot of recordings. Right now, I'm recording the complete works of Francois Couperin.
My God.
Do you know how
many? On harpsichord?
Yeah, that's only harpsichord.
Wow.
And basically, I finished 7 CDs of it already, and I have 3 more to go.
Oh, my God.
There are 27 suites, and each suite has about 15 pieces, well over 300 pieces, and hard. But that's the best harpsichord music in the world.
And you love it.
And
yes.
And Carol said, this is your legacy. It costs money. Gotta do it. And I said, I don't want to waste it. And it used to be we got paid for our recordings.
Yeah,
not
right.
anymore.
No, you know.
Not in America.
What?
Not in America.
No.
My European colleagues, I'm so jealous. They're still state supported. But you see, we have no what they call patrimony. The French support Francois Couperin. Mm-hmm. The Germans support Bach. The English support Handel and Purcell. Billions and millions of marks and francs and euros. I'll give you an example. Jealousy now.
Mm-hmm.
French harpsichordists, I don't know if they do it anymore because things have changed. When a French harpsichordist got a concert, anywhere, the French government would pay all of his expenses. So that means that he could ask for a lower fee than me.
That's right.
So they beat me out so many times.
Yes.
But he was a French citizen. I'm not. I like living in America. I mean, if I were the same person in Paris in the 50s when I grew up, I wouldn't be a harpsichordist now. I'm recording, playing what I want to now. The nice thing about being a harpsichordist, by the way, is that I could play until I drop dead, in the sense of physical.
Yes, right.
Because the harpsichord is played with only the fingertips.
Really? I had no idea.
You don't move your hands, arms. So pianists will have neck problems. I could play 24 hours a day, it wouldn't bother me. If you do it right.
Yes, right, of course.
Wind players probably are retired already by this time. You're sitting like this.
Oh, my God.
That's what you're playing.
Yeah.
And that's how they told you how to play, and that's all you need.
Right.
Why do you think it makes such a small sound? The harpsichord is a very light touch. It doesn't do you any good, nor is it necessary to
bang.
Bang or to use muscles.
Yes, right.
Oh, you have to hold, you know.
Yes, like you have that. To sit up, right.
Sit up, position. I wrote a book on that, on how to play the harpsichord, mm-hmm. and it's not as good as lessons. But anyhow, and and so I'm lucky.
Okay, so I only ask one more question, and it is, having given a life to the art of music and primarily the art of the harpsichord, what would you say about it or how you feel about it?
The art giving, devoting your life to music?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Lucky. Mm-hmm. Privileged. Blessed. Yeah. Man, many people can't. So I consider myself so fortunate.
Yeah. That's a great place to stop.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Mark Earl. So, lucky, blessed. This is how a person who is who they really are, doing what they were meant to do, talks about their life. And so, as I said, it is my hope that when you listen to someone like Mark, you are asking yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Am I in sync with myself as Mark Kroll so obviously is? Well, if not, again, you want to talk to me about that, come on up to my website, thelinshow.com. So as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use, something that inspired you. Anyway, something that'll bring you back, because I will be back. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. yet. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten